if you're not from the majority group, you don't see anyone else that looks like you, you think, well, I'm the odd one out, I must be wrong. But the truth is, you know, that as we've talked about, you know, the diversity is what like drives the innovation in yeah. science. And so when you, you know, you stick it out, you stick to your, you know, try to bring people along, I guess, to your perspectives. And in the long run, it's very satisfying.
The human brain is the most complex structure in the known universe, and we are in the middle of a scientific revolution to understand its inner workings. Join us for a conversation with world-renowned neuroscientists as they visit Rochester. I am Dr. John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester, and you are listening to Neuroscience Perspectives. Hello, and welcome to Neuroscience Perspectives. I'm John Fox. I'm the director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester. And I'm delighted to have with me here today, Professor Lucina Uden from the University of California in Los Angeles. Lucina is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences. And she works with functional neuroimaging to investigate brain connectivity and circuit activity in children and adolescents developing the developing brain with a concentration also on children with atypical development and intellectual disabilities. Lucina, it's really wonderful to have you here. And, you know, let's dive right in. Before we really get stuck into the science, I always like to begin by, you know, just finding out a little bit about you and your trajectory. I know you grew up in California, but you were born elsewhere. And do you want to tell us a little bit about your trajectory?
Well, I guess how far back do you want to go? So I was actually born in Bangladesh. My parents immigrated to the United States when I was an infant. And so it's a pretty typical immigrant story from South Asia. But I did grow up in Southern California and was fortunate enough to be able to come back to home a couple of years ago when I joined the psychiatry department at UCLA.
Terrific. And what took you into science? Was that a passion in school as a youngster, or is it a later developing thing?
You know, the opposite. In fact, I was not interested in science. I was interested in literature and language and arts. My father has a PhD in comparative literature, so no science in our home. It was not something I thought I would be doing. I did, however, become practically minded towards the college years and sort of entered a pre-med major, studied neuroscience. Mainly because at that age, you don't know what to do. You look at a list of 100 majors and you pick one. And, you know, being a child of immigrants, it seemed like, yes, I should be a doctor. It wasn't a whole lot of thought process that went into it. But towards the end of my undergraduate years studying neuroscience, I really began to just, you know, become fascinated with the brain. Of course, you know, what's not to like, right?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
one of the most interesting organs. But realized, of course, that I was not well suited to go to medical school and actually had no interest in following that particular career path. Lucky for me, I came to learn that there's other ways you can engage in science, and one of them is to become a neuroscientist. So that's what I ended up doing.
Right. Well, we won't get into the idea that the science is practical and everything else is impractical, right?
Right. So, that's not what I meant.
And it, actually, you know, it's interesting. Myself, I studied it when I started my studies. It was in literature and history, and I came to science quite late in life myself. Yeah. And I think it makes for an interesting trajectory. Mm-hmm. So your dad was an academic, so that must have been an influence on sort of choosing the academic life.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, just even realizing that one can get a PhD and specialize on a topic and study it for the rest of their lives, I think it's not always understood that that's a career path. So I think especially for people coming from other countries, it's they kind of want stability, economic stability.
Yeah,
that's
of course,
sort of
yeah.
one path to that is to go into a field like science engineering or medicine. So I think I appreciate having that kind of background to sort of, draw from in terms of thinking about when I mentor students from all over the world, kind of having an understanding of where they might be coming from might be different than growing up in a middle-class American family, for example.
Well, you know, like I hadn't intended to ask you this, but let's stay with this interface between, you know, coming from the humanities into science.
Sure.
Do you bring that into your science, or did you leave it behind you?
Oh, I bring it. I mean, I'm a huge reader. I love writing and literature to this day. I read at least one novel a month. Really into fiction and sci-fi. But I think what people don't realize is that a career in science requires so much writing and communication, and that's something you develop really very much so in the humanities. You know, you learn to write, you learn to communicate, you learn to convey complex ideas to a wide audience, and to really engage and bring people in. Why are we doing this? What makes it important? What's the significance? How does it help us understand the human condition? These are what the humanities train you for. So I think, you know, I never meant to say, oh, that wasn't practical. I think, in fact, all of that training, you know, helped me become, you know, the scientist.
I completely agree. I mean, you could have the greatest finding idea in the world, but if you can't turn it into words that you can communicate to people with, yeah, it may as well not exist.
Exactly. My PhD advisor actually said that if you, you know, did a study and didn't publish it, it's as if you didn't do it, because exactly, no one knows what you did.
Very good. That's terrific. I think that's a great advice actually to graduate students, that don't neglect that side of life. I actually live by a maxim myself, which is, if I don't have place in my life for a book that's not related to the job, my life is out of balance.
That's true.
Well, there's two things that I want to talk about. One, obviously, I want to get into the functional imaging,
sure,
and how you approach your science. And the other piece, you know, that our audience should know about is, you know, you have a very specific devotion to diversity, equity, and inclusion in the sciences, and you've put a big chunk of your career into that and won awards for in that space. So we'll get to talk about that, I think, shortly. But let's do the science piece first.
Yep.
You use big magnets.
Yes.
Right? Do you want to tell us a little bit about that and what it means and how you approach it?
Those of us who want to study the human brain, unfortunately, we have few options, because we can't do a lot of that really nice invasive work that our colleagues do and who work on animal models. So we can't do quite as much manipulation. We can't do quite as much of getting into you know, cellular mechanisms, because we're confined by what you can do to human subjects. So I've been working in magnetic resonance imaging since I was a PhD student, so I guess 20 years now. And we can, you know, of course, non-invasively look at the brain when people are doing certain things. We can look at their brain when they're doing nothing at all, which is something that's become very interesting in the last few years. So yeah, I've been trying to sort of push the limits of what we can do with this magnetic resonance imaging technology, because we're learning more and more about sort of, it's not just, you know, input comes into the brain and the brain does something and produces some output, but it turns out there's a lot of spontaneous activity in the brain, and we're only now just beginning to understand how that constrains function, constrains behavior, how it shapes kind of what we do. I think this is just a fascinating area that my lab has been thinking a lot about, this intrinsic activity, spontaneous activity. What does it mean? You know, what's it there for, and how can we use it to better understand brain function?
So this idea that there are brain states, that the networks are active in a certain way when things are good, and that you can even just image the brain at rest and understand when things are awry or off kilter, or
that's
the
right,
networks aren't working well.
Yep.
Give us an insight that we've gained from this. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I think people were surprised to find how coherent this activity is, and how you can find it in individuals over time. Like, for example, in your brain and my brain, we could find similar looking networks even in this, what we call resting state. When we're not in, even if we're just lying there, not doing anything at all, we would still be showing spontaneous, coherent, low frequency activity in what you might call a motor network or a language network or a visual network. Those are regions of the brain that would be cooperating if we were doing a motor task or a visual task or a language task. But it turns out they're just kind of spontaneously going, they're just going in loops all the time. And you can find them in individuals. You can find that they change over the lifespan. You can find some kind of signature alterations in some developmental conditions. It's just a whole new way of thinking about brain function that I think has really produced a lot of insights.
And I suppose a magic power of this particular technique then is that you don't have, you know, if you have children and you're very concentrated on development who can't answer a question or can't perform a complex task, it doesn't put a huge demand on that. You can actually look at function without having people doing somersaults for us.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, you can just have someone say, lay still for 5 minutes. And if you can get them to do that, you can actually collect this data, which tells you so much information about brain organization.
And gives it a clinical tractability component too.
That's right.
Really interesting.
Right. Yeah.
I happen to know, of course, that you are very involved with one of the, I think maybe the biggest study that NIH has ever, the National Institute of Health has ever really undertaken, the ABCD study, Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study, which
That's
is a mouthful.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and what your hopes and aspirations are for it?
Yeah, and I assume you're also very involved. So, this study that NIH has been funding now for close to 10 years has started with 9 and 10 year olds and a huge group of them, over 10,000 9 and 10 year olds, who came in and the data were collected across 21 sites all over the United States. So the idea was to get people from all over the place and just follow them up yearly with brain imaging measures and cognitive measures and behavioral measures, with the ultimate goal of trying to predict susceptibility, risk, and resilience to substance abuse and mental health disorders across this adolescent period. So it's just enormous, as you can imagine, both as a data collection effort and as a data dissemination effort and as a data analysis effort. So for years now, NIH has been sort of releasing the data to the public for researchers to use to answer all of these
key,
questions.
Right?
And that is key.
This is a very important piece, right? This is, the model has changed here. As scientists, we collected data in our labs. We kept it. We huddled around it. We kept it for
ourselves. Hoarded it.
Yeah. It was precious commodity.
Right.
But this is a change in the model. Do you want to talk about open science and
what
our hopes for that are?
I mean, open science is huge. The idea that the data that scientists collect should be made available for other scientists to use and answer, you know, whatever questions that they want to answer. This is huge. I actually started my lab about 10 years ago when this really took off. It used to be sort of unheard of that people would say, hey, I spent the last 5 years and $5 million collecting this data. Here, you have it.
Yeah.
But now it's actually mandated by the National Institute of Health to say, okay, you've spent all this effort. Great. Now let's see what others can do with it as well. And it brings the kind of collaboration that you know, really benefits all of us, because then you get computer scientists, electrical engineers, physicists, sometimes people coming with new approaches. You get people in other fields, just being able to work collaboratively with the people who have collected the data. And it just gets extra complicated and extra nuanced as a result. But I think this is the future of science.
Yeah. And I suppose there's two important distinctions. One is you mentioned $5 million, which is not atypical.
Yeah.
That $5 million comes from the American taxpayer.
That's right.
And they want value for money, right? Mm-hmm. So having those data looked at by one mind is nothing like having it looked at by all the brilliant minds that could potentially leverage it.
That's right.
But another piece, and this goes to what I want to talk to you about next, which is the diversity and inclusion, there are many people who don't live at a major academic center like the University of California in Los Angeles or the University of Rochester, where we have phenomenal resources. But there are great scientists and great minds out there at smaller places that don't have those resources, that can't get data like these.
Yeah.
So this provides that opportunity for them.
Exactly right. Yeah, that's what it did for me, because I started my lab at the University of Miami, where they were just starting a neuroimaging center at the time. So while I was waiting for things to pick up, you know, getting our scanner going, everybody's writing grants, during that time, I was able to analyze a lot of data sets that have been made available through these open science efforts. And one of them was called the Autism Brain Imaging Data Exchange, ABIDE. And so that's another one where researchers across the world really were putting their data together in one place, and you could download it, you could use it to look at brain connectivity and its development in autism, which is what I did for many years in the beginning, while waiting for our own grants to start, while waiting and doing our own data collection. So it really has just changed, I think, the way people do science now. You just see more and more of these large data, and not to mention the statistical power, the increase you get with looking at hundreds of subjects instead of looking at tens of subjects. So it's just been a win-win.
It has. And it's a nice segue into this issue of diversity, because another key component of the ABCD study, right? Mm-hmm. In the old days, an investigator would do a functional imaging study. At best, they'd have 20 or 30 people in there, and they probably all came from the local school, right?
Or the
you know, some organization, somebody's book club. But ABCD mm-hmm. changes that, right? Do you want to speak to that?
Well, it tries very hard to match the racial and ethnic diversity that we have in the United States. So it tries very hard to sort of get the percentages right. And that brings with it extra challenges because, you know, trying to get into, you know, get participants who maybe don't have as many resources to say, hey, I'm going to give you 5 hours out of my day to do a study. It's a different set of challenges than saying getting a college student to come in to do a study. So so this project is funny because I'm a newcomer to ABCD myself. So I joined UCLA 2 years ago and sort of was immediately sucked into this world of this big grant. And then just a year ago, I was appointed as the Associate Director for Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusivity for all of ABCD, which means now I'm talking with everybody, all the 21 sites, looking at what their local recruitment efforts are, what are the difficulties they're having with retention, especially from participants in minoritized populations, lots of issues related to justice, equity, diversity, and inclusivity, and all of the study have now sort of fallen under my umbrella, and now I have a team of individuals who I work with, you know, to sort of spread the JEDI efforts all throughout the consortium. So that has been quite an interesting challenge.
It's a tour de force and a real challenge because, yeah. And I suppose, you know, having been early enough in the ABCD, you know, people started out with the best intentions.
Of course.
But of course, I don't think we had a real appreciation for the true barriers that are out there for people who come from hardscrabble backgrounds,
right.
who don't have the economic means for them to stay involved in the in the study, the mobility in those communities, mm-hmm. the lack of a bus fare. This mm-hmm. comes down to such basic, simple things that militate against participation and how intentional we need to be as a community.
It's for me, it's been a whirlwind tour of just learning while trying to do justice to this role, which I think was very forward thinking for the directors to say, hey, we actually need an entire person devoted to thinking about these issues, an entire team that's now funded to do that. So, you know, we've talked a lot throughout our symposium today about how the funding, you know, bodies like National Institute of Health can help us think this way to be more inclusive in our science. And we just had wonderful presentations already about this. But part of it is just as simple as money. Have you provided, means for transportation or meals during this, you know, things that make it easier for people to provide childcare, even if they have other children who need, you know, care and they want to bring in their adolescent to the study? Maybe we have to provide means for that as well. So, I mean, just thinking these issues through is a big step.
Right. And taking off hours of a work day for, you know, when you're a professional who can get time off. But if you're a shift worker, you know, it's
hard.
You know, it's we were talking about best intentions. But at the end of the day, you have to actually deploy resources and human power and knowledge. And I think, you know, you're at the pointy end of the stick on this. And I think as an ABCD investigator, we really appreciate what you team are doing.
It's a tall order. And that's why we really need buy-in from everybody. And that's part of what it is that everyone at ABCD and studies like this, we've all realized we don't live in a academic ivory tower bubble, or maybe we do, but if we want to really make the kind of impact that we are hoping to make, we just have to take all of these factors into consideration.
And I mean, just coming back to where we started, does your Bangladeshi background, your immigrant background, do you feel like that's helped you in this role?
I mean, for sure. I think part of what we're combating now is also this idea of medical mistrust or just mistrust in science. And there's a lot of reasons why some communities would not want to come in and participate in a research study. And it helps me to understand some of that. I can tell you, like, as an immigrant, we only became citizens, you know, through the naturalization process. And you may not want to, to reveal to an institution what your immigration status is in the United States, contentious issues. There's a lot of things going on right now with sexual and gender minorities in some states in the United States where it's becoming more and more dangerous for those individuals to exist. And so in our study, we might ask these questions that some people are even afraid to answer. So, you know, just being sensitive to, you know, this, like with the things we're asking, we're doing this because we want to help these communities. But at the same time, we have to build trust with the communities so that they know, hey, we're doing this for you, not, you know, it's for some nefarious purpose.
Right. And I would say there's a saying, right, that, you know, the strength in science is in its diverse minds and bringing people from different backgrounds together. Mm-hmm. And I personally believe that's one of the great achievements of the American science engine, is that it took minds and brilliance from wherever it could get it. And I rue the day that they would decide not to do that, because that is what's driven innovation in this country.
Right.
Now, you know, I really appreciate that. I appreciate you wading into what is difficult political territory.
Sure,
I mean,
is.
It's not easy to talk about. Mm-hmm. I always like to close with this question. Yeah. For youngsters up and coming, you know, you've traveled a certain path, mm-hmm. you know, from an immigrant family and the humanities and so on. When you turn around and you talk to your graduate students, or even if you're out in the school system, mm-hmm. what do you say to youngsters? What do you say about, you know, do you have some nuggets, tips for life?
For life? Oh, wow.
Or the academy.
It's interesting because I was not by any means a traditional success story. I think it took a long time for me to get off the ground. I mean, in terms of, you know, I was a postdoc for something like 7 years, which may be more typical nowadays, just a larger commentary on academia in general. But, you know, I didn't think that I would succeed in this career path. There was no indication I would for many, many years. I struggled. I didn't get my first faculty position until, you know, about 10 years ago. It's a lot of investment that you put in, not sort of knowing what will come out the other end. But, you know, and people will give you all kinds of advice, but it's kind of the survivorship bias. Like, this worked for me. That doesn't necessarily mean it'll work for anybody else. But one thing that I found that I couldn't move away from was this kind of like, I have a unique perspective, and I'm just going to keep doing the thing that I think needs to be done, whether it's looking at spontaneous brain activity when nobody else cared about that, or, you know, whether it's, you know, looking at certain populations using, you know, certain approaches. I have a unique perspective, and I'm going to be here, and I'm going to bring that perspective to academia, whether they want it or not.
Yeah.
And it turns out eventually they do want it, because, sometimes, if you're not from the majority group, you don't see anyone else that looks like you. You think, well, I'm the odd one out. I must be wrong. But the truth is, you know, that as we've talked about, you know, the diversity is what like drives the innovation in science. And so when you stick it out, you stick to your, you know, try to bring people along, I guess, to your perspectives. And in the long run, it's very satisfying, but it is a uphill battle, and the only thing that sort of keeps you going is the mentors and allies and friends and collaborators that you meet along the way who support you in that path. So so there's the both sort of don't lose your hope, even though it sometimes looks bleak, but also like rely on those friends and connections and collaborations, because that's what makes it all possible and worthwhile.
That's fantastic. You know, we hear this again and again when I ask this question, mentors, the people that give you a leg up in life. And what I hear is perseverance, single-mindedness, and hard work.
Well, the mentors, and it's true, you can't do it without mentors, colleagues, friends.
Lucina, thank you very much for taking time out. It's really been a pleasure to chat with you and to introduce you to our audience.
Thank you.
Thank
it's
you
been
so
a pleasure.
Much for being here.
Thank you so much.